I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. The Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. just issued a briefing paper that was released in Milwaukee a couple hours ago at City Hall. It's titled, Do Poor Kids Deserve Lower Quality Education Than Rich Kids? Evaluating School Privatization Proposals in Milwaukee. The author of the very thorough and lengthy report is with us this hour, Gordon Lafer. Gordon is a political economist and an associate professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center. He's written extensively on issues of labor and employment policy, served as an economic policy analyst for the Office of the Mayor in New York City, has also served as senior policy advisor for the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Education and Labor, and holds a Ph.D. in political science from Yale. We'll be looking at a lot of issues, what's happened to public education, particularly in Milwaukee the last couple of years. Those who are backers of a different kind of education are, there's a lot of emphasis in the report on this rocket ship chain of schools. There's one in Milwaukee that opened last summer, but there are plans for more of those. And essentially calling for public schools to be replaced by a different kind of operation, heavy on technology, light on teachers, and it comes, as Gordon writes, from some of the most powerful actors in local and national politics. So we have a lot on the table this hour. We're going to welcome you to join our conversation about the future of public schools, particularly in Milwaukee. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Gordon. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I assume you chose Milwaukee in part because we have been the center for changes in education, voucher schools, charter schools for a long time now.
That's right. And, you know, a lot of what is promoted is to say, oh, parents should have choice. And I think if there's any place you would say parents have already a huge amount of choice, you know, public, private, voucher, charter, religious, non-religious, it's Milwaukee. So it is one of the most telling places to look at what's happening in education reform.
The title of this paper is provocative. Do poor kids deserve lower quality education than rich kids? Are they getting a lower quality education?
Well, I think the issue is, and what the title talks to is, there are proposals that were debated in the Wisconsin state legislature that are similar to things being debated in other states that would have said when schools are low performing in Milwaukee, public schools will be closed and replaced with privately run charter schools. And there's obviously a wide variety of charter schools. There is no evidence at either the national or local level to think that just replacing a public school with a privately run charter school is going to make things work better. That's not what the data shows. But also there's a particular kind of charter school that the backers of this legislation are very enamored of, which, as you described in the introduction, partly replaces teachers with computers. And it's a kind of school that if you look at what are ranked as the best schools in Wisconsin and schools that more privileged parents send their kids to, that they would not accept for their own kids. And, you know, my feeling is, I'm not a policymaker, but my feeling is in general we should not be promoting schools that we wouldn't send our own kids to. And what it looks like is that a model of school is being said, this is good for poor kids in Milwaukee, but not for more privileged kids elsewhere in the state.
And is it an overstatement to say that that model really changes things dramatically? So it's not what's best for children and what's best for education. In a sense, you're serving corporations. Is that an overstatement?
Well, you know, it's a lot of different things going on, and there are some well-intentioned people involved in, you know, probably in every school trying to do the right thing. But I think the model, which is being promoted in a lot of poor cities, which is this model that says you reduce the curriculum pretty much to just English and math. You replace a lot of the teachers with technology. The rest of the teachers you take mostly from Teach for America, which was described today by somebody as the temp agency for America's schools, right, where you have very young, very inexperienced, very high turnover teachers, rocket ship schools. About 30% of the teachers leave every year. So it's a very high turnover rate, more than double what MPS is. So you have the poorest, most needy, hardest to educate kids getting the least experience, highest turnover teachers, and spending a big chunk of their day with technology and not with teachers at all. And when you look at what drives that model, in a lot of cases, what drives it is making money as opposed to doing right by kids. So, for instance, they use software for the math program, which is not, you would not use, I think, if you were just saying, what's the best way to teach these kids math, but is backed by people who are financially connected to the company and who are making money off of it. This is also a company, Rocketship in particular, but there are other schools like it, that is very, very ambitious for growth, wants to have hundreds and hundreds of schools, and says in its own documents, our plan is to reduce the number of teachers, reduce the number of adults in the classroom, substitute more computers for teachers, get rid of some of the assistant principals, so that we can suck out a couple hundred thousand dollars more from each school to fund growth in other parts of the country, which means, you know, that money from Milwaukee taxpayers will be going to fund growth, and that it's not based on what's best for the kids, but what's based for the, you know, what fits the company's corporate growth plans.
And as you say in the report, it has profound ramifications for an MPS school district, for the public school district, which exists and educates most of the children in this city right now, because they have obligations for special needs students. They have obligations in terms of pensions and health care for retired teachers. They would lose a lot of money, and it would have a huge impact on MPS, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would have a financial impact on MPS. And what, you know, charter schools screen their populations in various ways. For instance, in Rocketship, parents are required to sign a guarantee that they will do 30 hours of volunteer work in the school during the year. So a lot of parents who don't have the confidence to do that, or kids and parents and families where they don't have a parent, or they're living with another relative, or they're homeless, or they're moving around a lot, won't sign that. And then they have MPS has 21% of the kids in MPS are special needs, only 5% in Rocketship. So if you take things like that and money goes out of the system, and in some ways that are kind of technical, like, but the MPS loses Title I money, MPS is responsible for the pensions of retired teachers and the charter schools are not. What you, between those two things, the creaming and the way the money works, is what it produces is that the neediest kids who have the most severe needs and who are hardest to serve and most expensive to serve are going to be left trapped in a shrinking MPS system, which has less and less money to take care of them, which is going to be a disaster for those kids, you know, apart from anything else.
The whole voucher movement, there were many well-intentioned people who started that movement here many years ago. There are well-intentioned people who are looking at the statistics from MPS, and they're not very pretty, the number of dropouts, the problems in terms of African-American and white test scores. I mean, there are substantial problems in the district. So aren't those many of those well-intentioned people believing for some reason that a charter system, a Rocketship system, is going to bring more success to those students who are needy?
You know, there are education is a huge debate that there's lots of different people and lots of different advocacy groups or just parents who are involved in. But when you look at which legislation tends to pass in states across the country, it tends to be the legislation that has the backing of the most powerful political lobbies in the country, which are the big business lobbies, the Chamber of Commerce, Americans for Prosperity, National Association of Manufacturers. And those organizations are pushing this model of education. And I don't think it's because, I mean, look, I don't want to pretend that I'm inside anybody else's head, but it's not coming from a set of parents who said, we don't think our kids are doing well in the voucher schools or MPS, and we want them to spend more time on computers. It's coming from the business community, and it is driven in large part by business interests. And I guess one other thing I would like to, you know, to add in terms of the connection with the corporate lobbies, I mean, the push for Rocketship really came from the Milwaukee Association of Commerce, which advocated for it, which raised $2.5 million to bring Rocketship to Milwaukee. The president of the MMAC sits on Rocketship's board. You know, the number one thing that I think any scholar will say that affects education is poverty. Now, if you could do anything, you know, to improve education here, it would be to enable more parents to work their way out of poverty. You can't say, I'm against the minimum wage, I'm against the living wage, I'm against the right to paid sick leave, but I'm for education. And you know, poverty is within the control of the state legislature. It's not within the control of the school system. What is more within the control of the school system is class size. That's the other of the things that are inside the school. Class size is the number one thing that most scholars point to as making an impact on education. So in the case of the MMAC and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and Americans for Prosperity, they have supported the budget cuts, which make small class sizes impossible, even though it's Wisconsin policy to encourage them. And they have opposed the living wage here in Milwaukee. They've opposed increasing the minimum wage. They've opposed the right to paid sick leave here in Milwaukee. And so in a way, there's this ironic situation where you have these big corporate lobbies that are creating the conditions of failure by underfunding the schools and by making it harder for people to work their way out of poverty, and then saying, huh, you're failing. Now let us come in and give you our preferred solution.
And you also, in the report, talk about Wisconsin's 2011-2012 budget resulting in cuts of $702 per student in high-poverty districts compared with cuts of $318 in wealthier districts. State reimbursement for the school district's special education costs, I did not know this, which had once been set at 70%, has eroded to 26%.
That's right. So it's a, you know, when you say that MPS is taking care of 21% of the student body with special needs, that's a hugely expensive burden that is borne mostly by the local community.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to teachers for a moment. We do a lot of education shows, and when you think about your life, when I think about my life and our children's lives, it's always been somebody who notices what talent you have, who helps you along, that we need a mentor somewhere along the way, and I think probably for at least 80% of us, it's a teacher. The thing that bothers me about this model, and maybe I'm just old and I'm out of date with this, but it taking away a fabulous teacher, I would think would have a negative impact on education, because aren't they what's most important about education?
I think that's right. And obviously, you know, there are good and bad teachers every place, and we've all had both good and bad teachers. But on average, like other things, teachers get better. You know, more experienced teachers are better. Teachers get better with experience. If you look at, for instance, the Wisconsin superintendents every year vote for who's the Wisconsin Teacher of the Year.
Right.
So over the last 10 years, on average, the Wisconsin Teacher of the Year has been on the job for 18 years. And, you know, I would say I've done this research as a policy analyst, but I also have a 7-year-old daughter who's in second grade with a great teacher, but in a school where they have music and physical education only 9 weeks a year, and they laid off all the librarians. So I know how hard teachers work. I also know that when the parents walk into school, nobody wants a first-year teacher. They might want them as the assistant teacher in the classroom because they're perky and energetic and fun, but nobody wants a new teacher supervising a class of 30 kids. And so what we have now is, you know, the kids who need the most, and I think need the most in the way that you said. It's not just that they need to read and write. You need somebody who's going to notice, like, who is quiet and shut down and needs to learn how to use their voice? Who has too much anger and needs to learn how to control it? Who's a loner or a bully and needs to learn how to work in groups? Like, these are things about how you grow as a person that a teacher needs to be able to do. And you need, in general, experienced teachers and small classes to develop people that way. And that's where privileged parents send their kids to school, is schools like that.
So Rocket Ship says in their PR, and we said they had one school in Milwaukee, they talk about 90,000 elementary-age children living in the city of Milwaukee, yet only 46% will graduate from high school. And they believe they can change that and make it dramatically different. Their plan is initially to open 8 high-quality schools in Milwaukee by 2018. Why shouldn't we give them a chance to try? Maybe they can really tackle that number, and maybe the model of education is something that might work.
You know, I'm for trying lots of things, but I would not try in the dark. I mean, people have been studying education for 100 years or more, and we know a lot about what makes for good schools and what makes for bad schools. And you can see where the good schools are if you just say, where do rich people send their kids to school, right? Rocket Ship, I don't know how they, you know, why they're talking about the high school graduation rate. They're only in elementary school. They go up to fifth grade. They did have good test scores if you measure education just by test scores in their first few years, but they've gone down considerably. They've gone down by 10%. As happens with many schools and many things, that, like, you know, you have an initial startup and there's a charismatic person or a set of people who are throwing themselves into it, and then you decide instead of being one school, you want to be 20 schools, and things dissipate and you become more bureaucratic. Last year, 4 of the 7 schools had failed to make adequate yearly progress under the federal No Child Left Behind for the second year in a row, which means they were under mandated federal remediation, where they had to set aside money for more teacher training. They had to bring in outsiders to examine what they were doing wrong and what they could do better. Now, that doesn't mean they couldn't improve. It doesn't mean there couldn't be some kids who do well there. But what it does mean is the idea that, oh, we found it. Here's the model that is going to save Milwaukee. The minimum you could say is, A, it's without any evidence, and B, it's driven in large part by financial considerations. So, for instance, the math, one of the main math programs that Rocket Ship kids use and when they're sitting in front of computers is a program called DreamBox. When the U.S. Department of Education evaluated DreamBox, they said there are 11 studies out there about DreamBox, all funded by DreamBox. 10 of them are junk science because they were done statistically no good. And the 11th one, the U.S. Department of Education looked at it and concluded that DreamBox had no impact whatsoever on math scores. Then they got the authors of the report, who were I think was commissioned by Rocket Ship, redid the numbers, and the U.S. Department of Education upgraded to potentially positive impacts based on small evidence. So if you were a principal and somebody said, here's a program, it has somewhere between no discernible impacts and potentially significant, potentially positive based on small evidence, I think what you'd think is like, huh, what else is out there, right? Can we find something better? But the people who own DreamBox are some of the same people who are funding the expansion of the Rocket Ship network. Because if Rocket Ship has 100 schools, every additional school, every additional kid is more money to DreamBox, which is a for-profit company owned by these investors. So they're making decisions not just based on what's good for the kids. And, you know, this kind of arrangement would be illegal for a public official because of ethics laws. If the Milwaukee superintendent said, I want MPS to use a software program, and the company is owned by my sister, right, but don't worry about it, you can't do that. But these private charter companies are not bound by the same ethics rules as public officials, and they don't follow them.
Let's go to phone calls. We have a number of people who are calling in. The Economic Policy Institute just issued a briefing paper. It was released in Milwaukee because the focus of the report is Milwaukee. It is titled, Do Poor Kids Deserve Lower Quality Education Than Rich Kids? Evaluating School Privatization Proposals in Milwaukee. The author of the report is our guest this hour, Gordon Lafer, political economist, associate professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Hour two of our program, we've been doing some pretty meaty topics. We thought we ought to laugh a little bit, so we're going to be talking with the co-author of The Humor Code. It's a global search for what makes things funny. And they're also, you probably saw in the New York Times, the Sunday, what do you call it now? It's Sunday Review of the funniest cities in the United States. So maybe we'll even hear some jokes. But actually, we'll hear how to win the New Yorker cartoon contest. Those of you who do that will get good advice. To your phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gordon Lafer is our guest this hour, and let's go to some of your many phone calls. We start with Al in Toma. Hi, Al.
Good afternoon. Question for you. I noticed that when you were talking about groups that were putting money into education, probably the number one and largest spending group, the teachers' union, wasn't mentioned. I wonder why that you failed to mention the teachers' union.
The reforms that have been considered here in the Wisconsin State Legislature have not, you know, the ones that have gotten the furthest, which is what my report focuses on, is the ones that got the furthest and that the legislative leadership has said that they are interested in reconsidering in the next session. None of them, a very mild bill passed this year that just increases reporting requirements but doesn't have any sanctions for schools. But in any case, the bills that got the furthest were the ones that were supported by the major corporate lobbies. And so I'm kind of looking at trying to understand those bills and trying to understand what the interests are behind them.
Okay, so the teachers union didn't put any money into lobbying on any side of this or writing any legislation?
Certainly not the bills that got, that kind of came close to passage that got hearings in the legislature. And I'm looking at the school accountability legislation, and the most ambitious version which was not even formally introduced, but was drafted by Senator Olson, who is chairman of the Education Committee. And that's what the Senate Majority Leader has said that he wants to reconsider next year, as the kind of principles and proposals involved in that. And I don't think the teachers union had anything to do with drafting that.
I bet if you looked at the state of Wisconsin budget, you'd find education is probably either the largest or one of the largest spending line items on the budget. Is there ever a point where you would say, gee, I think they're spending enough money on education now?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact. The Wisconsin 20 years ago adopted a program called SAGE, which said that we should, in high poverty districts, that the state's aim was to lower class size to 18 for kindergarten to third graders. And if we were able, I shouldn't say we, I don't live here. If you were able to do that, I think that was spending well. Unfortunately, that the money for that has been frozen and not adjusted for inflation for 20 years. And so it's still kind of official state policy to encourage small class size, which I think is what every parent, you know, without doing any research, wants for their kid. But that's not there. And actually, over the last 6 years since the recession, Wisconsin has cut more dollars per student than any other state in the country besides Alabama. So is there a point? Of course. It doesn't look like you're there right now.
The legislature, you're right, cut real spending $2,038 per child, measuring from pre-recession spending levels. Thanks, Al, for your call. Let's go to Ruth in Milwaukee. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, I'm not advocating either program, but if you have a program that's failing, why do you want to continue it? Give something else a chance.
I agree entirely. I think it's important to measure failure correctly. And, you know, one of the most important things there is to really measure poverty and really measure special education, right? If what failing means is you get low test scores, and if the reason you get low test scores is because you have very poor kids from neighborhoods of concentrated poverty and they're not sleeping well at night, they don't go to doctors, they don't have good vision care, they're not getting good nutrition. I mean, all kinds of reasons that we know that make poverty so, in general, what the national studies show is that 50% of anybody's test scores is explained by wealth and poverty. So I completely agree that failing schools, you know, if a school is really failing, then you should look for a way to make it better. There are examples of how to make it better in every type of school, including within the public school system. There's no evidence to say the answer to failing schools in the public system is to replace them with private charter schools. And I do think that the measurement, you know, in the bills that were floated that did not pass but that were proposed last session, they did not adequately account for poverty. And so then you end up just saying, all right, the schools that have wealthier kids get declared success and the schools that have poor kids get declared failure. And I'm sure that's not what you mean.
You're also talking about, if we can just talk about this philosophical difference here for a moment, it seems to me as though public education is kind of a bedrock in many ways of American democracy, that it's been around for a long time and we've been dedicated to educating all children. Everybody can walk through the door and be educated, and you would hope that it would be at a high level and that there wouldn't be great disparity among rich districts and poor districts. To move from that kind of Jeffersonian model to a for-profit education system in this country seems to me, well, we don't know exactly what would happen to it, but there could be really profound and maybe not all positive, maybe they would be, changes in something that's so fundamental to what makes our country operate. Are people thinking about that? What are the possible consequences?
I think people are thinking about that, right? And one of the consequences is that when you have privately run charter schools, they're not subject to a publicly elected board. And I, you know, personally, I don't care if it's the Milwaukee School Board or a different board, but I feel like any school should be governed by a board that's elected by either the parents of the kids there or the taxpayers who are paying for the school. And without that kind of public accountability, like, that's what allows the kind of financial deal making to go on, is when you don't have somebody who's accountable to the public and who is under ethics rules where they really are bound to do just, you know, what's best for the kids and not what might be financially best.
So what is in the best interest then of these corporations who are, I mean, not, what is it, what is their ultimate goal here? Why all of a sudden have these organizations, corporate entities, become so involved in education? It must be more than they're going to make a buck off it, isn't it?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, of course, it's a big world and there's a lot of people with different motives. But in general, you know, 20 years ago, the Chamber of Commerce and the big business, you know, education was not, maybe they wanted workforce training, but like education was not a big thing they were spending a lot of time on. And because of privatization, there is a tremendous amount of money to be made in the school system.
There are, and
by the way, it's bipartisan. I know Wisconsin, like many places, has been a very, you know, politically divided state. But there is Democratic money in Wall Street and Democratic money in venture capital in Silicon Valley in California. It's across the board. But every major investment bank now has a division just for education. There are tons of venture capital firms and hedge funds that are just looking at education. And mostly what they're looking at is the replacement of teachers with technology. And part of that is that the big corporate lobbies lobby for bills that says a class that is taught, a course that is taught by a computer has to get paid the same dollars per kid as a regular class. And that makes the profit margins enormous. And that's why the hedge funds and Wall Street and all those guys are looking at it. They're looking at it the same way they looked at the mortgage industry before they managed to financialize the mortgage industry and crash the economy, which is they say, wait a minute, education is a $500 billion industry in America, and we don't have almost any piece of it. There's a lot of money to be made here. So you also see things like Wall Street money in Board of Education elections, local Board of Education elections, I mean, in big cities, but they never used to be there, or in local city elections, because now they think cities have something to sell, and that thing is the school system.
Thank you, Ruth, for the call. Eugene and Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. I'm just plain angry with our state legislature in Walker. Was for the expansion of the voucher and the charter schools. We cannot afford two school systems. With the expansion of the voucher and the charter schools, all we are going to do is ruin the public schools. And I'll take comments off the air.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call, Eugene.
Yeah, I think the idea that you have two school systems, and not because there's different choices. Of course, there should be different choices and different kinds of schools, and parents should get to decide what's the best, you know, kind of education for their kid. But because one of them does not have to take every kid, and so what you end up with is, you know, all the easiest, you know, high scoring kids in one place, and everybody else in another place, and that place gets starved of money. And by the way, the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, which is one of the corporate funded think tanks in a national network, in 1989 and 90, they said vouchers is the thing that's going to save Milwaukee very strongly. Everybody, we have to convert to vouchers. They put out a report last year where they said, okay, now it's 20 years later, vouchers didn't work. You know, I mean, obviously there's some good voucher schools, some bad voucher schools, but that on the whole, there's no difference, right? And that is what the data show. They said it didn't work. And they say, but now trust us. Now private charters using technology are the thing that's going to work. And they did polling here in Milwaukee, and they report the polling and they say, well, we're really surprised, but the public in Milwaukee does not agree with our experts. The public in Milwaukee does not want their kids taught online. And they think for some reason that more money will help the schools. And, you know, you would think maybe after 25 years of everybody's experience, they would conclude maybe the public and parents know what they're talking about. But instead they say, no, the public must misunderstand the situation and we really need these technology charter schools. And let me just say one thing about technology is obviously there's a important role for technology in the classroom. And if you look at rich kids' schools, they also have a lot of technology, but it's used in a fundamentally different way. Privileged kids are active users of technology. They learn how to write programs. They learn how to make movies online. They learn how to do graphic layouts online. What poor kids are given is to be passive users of technology, where they're hooked up to what are essentially video game-based things, where it's like you need to solve this math equation to make your way through the forest or something like that. And so it's not a question of being pro or anti-technology. It is a question of, you know, what expectations do you have for kids and how broad is their education, mm-hmm. and do they have a real teacher helping them with it?
You mentioned Rocket Ship being the company that's favored in Wisconsin. Are there a lot of these companies around right now, Gordon?
There are not a lot, but they aim to grow very quickly. Rocket Ship now has 9 schools and 5,000 students nationally, but they say that they want to have 30,000 by 5 years from now, and at some point after that, 1 million students in 50 cities. And what they're looking at is all poor cities where the testing and Common Core will be used to declare schools failing, and then instead of their industry growing one school at a time, it can grow 30 schools at a time or 40 schools at a time. And the reason that they're – and it's not just Rocketship. There are other schools like this. But the reason why this model of education I think is such a concern is that it has so much money behind it, such powerful actors behind it. If it was just advocates or a bunch of parents, like, okay, fine, go have an experiment, a couple schools like that, see how it works. But there is big Wall Street and venture capital money behind it, and they are trying to grow as fast as they can. So it's quite small now. There's one school here in Milwaukee, but they have authorization to open seven more here. But it's being promoted as something for poor cities around the country.
Thanks, Eugene, for the call. Susan in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I would just like to say a couple of things. I'm totally pro public schools. I love it that the public broadcast station carries the school board meetings when they're occurring. And many of the people in my family and many of my friends have been teachers, and they've basically taught in Head Start or the public schools. And my mother taught for 31 years in the state of Wisconsin. I'm not sure who said it. I think it was Ben Franklin, or possibly it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, both wonderful statesmen in the United States. But what they said is, if you do not pay for education, you will be paying for prisons. And that's where I'd like to just go offline. You know, it's like prisons are big money, too. So, I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, but I do know that the choice programs do not work. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Hannah. Hi, Hannah.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
In full disclosure, I'd like to recognize that my father is a public school teacher and has been for over 30 years. He has never complained about pay his entire career, but has been in a union. He's teaching his kids, grandkids at this point. He's been teaching so long, and nothing makes him happier than hearing he's changed somebody's life. So that's his payment. Anyway, what I was going to say is, going to school board meetings since I was 10 years old, looking into the school system and being very interested in it myself, my son, when I had him, I got him right into private school because he is young right now, and I was concerned about the state of Wisconsin schools in general. Now, he was in private school for preschool, 4K, kindergarten, and first grade, and now we're noticing that he needs his he has so many special needs that we have to send him to a public school. And it is so very unfortunate. I see so many private schools making it difficult for special needs children. Their test scores go up, and then the special needs children go to the schools. The schools are considered failing, and they get less money. It is unconscionable to me. And I suppose I can take my comment off the air as well.
All right. Thanks, Hannah.
Yeah, I mean, the caller raises a critical point, which is, even charter schools are supposed to serve special needs students as well, but they do a lot of what's called counseling out, where they'll come to parents and say, we don't really think we can give your child what they deserve. Well, what parent is going to keep their kid in a school that tells them that? And so you go to the public school, right? And then the public school has kids who score lower on test scores, and then they say, oh, these schools are failing. And it is, I think it is a crime, right, that the kids who actually need help or not can't go to any school, don't really have choice, and end up in schools that have less resources than are needed to take care of them. And, it's a huge thing. Both, I think I mentioned Rocketship has 5% of its kids have special needs, compared to 21% in MPS. But it's not just special needs, but the kind of need. Like MPS breaks down special needs kids according to three different classes of how serious the need is. I toured the Rocketship School here in Milwaukee, and one of the questions I asked them was about special needs kids. And I said, so do you have a special education teacher? Do you have a separate class? And I was told, no, they're all in the computer lab with everybody else. Well, if they're all in the computer lab with everybody else, that means their special needs are relatively mild compared to some other kids. And so, again, I think you know, as I, when I became a parent, I thought, all right, parenting is like the great equalizer because you see how precious and malleable your own kid is,
yes,
and you can't help but recognize that everybody else's kid is the same way. But for too many policymakers, that's not the case. They put other people's kids in schools that they wouldn't accept for their own kids.
That's, isn't that interesting when people do that? You mentioned Rahm Emanuel in the report, who's really, you know, changing things in the city of Chicago, but his kids go to the University of Chicago special school, school, right?
That's right. And I'm, you know, I don't have any problem with, you know, individual parent needs to decide what's right for their kid. A parent decides to send their kid to private school, that's fine. But when a policymaker
right.
who is sending other people's kids to, you know, schools that don't have resources. Yeah, Rahm Emanuel's kids go to a school where they have 7 full-time art teachers, and their director says, we don't believe in evaluating teachers based on test scores, and, you know, foreign languages and physical education and the arts are not frills. They're a part of the core curriculum. You know, I feel like if I had to sum up educational policy in one sentence, I would say, I want my kid to have what Rahm's kids have. I want everybody's kids to have what Rahm's kids have.
Thanks for your call. Let's go next to, where are we going here? Pam in Milwaukee. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Pam.
I just wanted to give a specific example so that your listeners and any comment from your guests would be involved here. You know, Rocket Ship School came in to an area, of course, that had an MPS school, or several schools actually around, but I'm aware of one specific one that had decided, as we know, many library media specialists have been cut in Milwaukee as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular MPS school had chosen to have a library media specialist full-time in the fall. And they had budgeted money to do that. And in the process of Rocket Ship recruiting children in that neighborhood, the school itself that was projecting that they would have enough students to cover the position found that they would not. And as a result, in the fall after Third Friday, when they determine the funding issues for Milwaukee Public School individual schools,
mm-hmm.
They cut the position to zero.
Mm.
So there's a specific example of the impact that has on children in the public schools. It also shows, from my experience, that a library media specialist in a public in any school is a valuable resource in terms of applying technology in a way that really has an educational impact. There's a lot of studies out there that show that. Critical thinking and all of the other things that are involved, as well as purchasing materials that cover the gamut of reading levels and interests and all of those things.
Yeah, I don't think you'll get argument. As a matter of fact, in the report, you mentioned the importance of librarians and school libraries.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of evidence of the importance of school librarians, of having a trained, certified professional librarian. And Rocket Ship does not have libraries or librarians. So they, in this case, apparently took one away from a public school, but do not have one themselves. And I just want to say again, librarians have been shown to improve people's test scores, but much more than that, they help kids learn how to do research. They help kids find books that the kids never would have didn't know about by themselves, but they say, oh, you're interested in rockets, you might like this book over here, so that they help kids develop a pleasure in reading and not have it just be a chore. And they also give kids books to read on the same subjects that they're doing in class, but different books, which means they get different perspectives and they learn critical thinking in that way. And these things, you know, critical thinking and love of reading don't necessarily show up on test scores, but they are part of, you know, becoming a fully developed human being. They are part of what we consider a good education. So I think the librarians are absolutely critical to that.
Our number is 800-486-8655. We have one line open right now. We're talking about a report just released a couple hours ago in Milwaukee, done by the Economic Policy Institute in D.C., and the author of the report is with us this hour, Gordon Lafer, political economist, associate professor in the University of Oregon's Labor, Education, and Research Center. The report is titled, Do Poor Kids Deserve Lower Quality Education Than Rich Kids? Evaluating School Privatization Proposals in Milwaukee. To you, more of you in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. I must ask you, Gordon, when you look at the achievement gap between those who have and those who don't, and usually people of color are poorer in our society. This gap has been around for a long, long time, no matter what kind of administration we've had in Wisconsin, Democratic or Republican. And nobody seems to have been able to address this huge gap. Nobody's been able to address the graduation rates not being very good, some schools not being very good. So why isn't there a group that maybe isn't funded by business but funded by somebody else to really take on this issue and offer us an alternative? At least, you know, Rocket Ship is saying, as one of our callers said, well, they're offering an alternative. Nobody's doing much on the other side. Is that a fair criticism?
No, I would say that's not a fair criticism in Milwaukee of all places. There are I don't know, an enormous number of alternatives within Milwaukee. And some of them are, you know, some of the highest performing schools are public schools. I think I mentioned the report, the Alba School, which is a bilingual school here, which is a charter school but chartered by MPS, by the district, outperformed every one of the privately run charter schools. And, you know, that's a place that you would look to say, okay, well, what are you doing right? I mean, some of it, as I said, you know, the single biggest impact on education is poverty. So if you say we're not going to do anything about poverty, and then we're going to keep saying, oh, my God, how come the schools don't get better? You know, it's not rocket science. It's a, you know, and some of this is policy decisions that get made at the state legislative level. Class size is another one. You know, mm-hmm. no matter what mm-hmm. your instructional format, no matter what curriculum you're using, no matter whether you have a 23-year-old teacher or a 60-year-old teacher, everybody does better when you have 18 kids than when you have 35 kids.
Right.
And when you – I mean, I see this. You have 35 kids. You're going to have 5 kids who are troublemakers in some way. You're going to have 5 kids who are precocious loudmouths. And you have 20 kids in the middle who you say, oh, thank God I don't have to pay attention to them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're doing crowd control. So I think you know, the fact is that, you know, to a large degree, education is an art and not a science, and it can't be reduced to a formula. But especially when you talk about poor kids and the achievement gap in poor cities and in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty, that we know that poverty matters, we know that small class size matters, and we know that experienced teacher matters. Like, you know, a few callers ago, there was a woman who talked about her dad having been a mentor to all these different
yes.
kids, both officially as a teacher and unofficially. And for so many people, you know, people who make it out of poverty often point back to one person, not every teacher, but one person who said, there is this person who saw me, right, who saw the potential, who believed in me, but also who saw me for what I was, right?
Yes.
And kids are different things. Some kids are book readers, some kids are artists, some kids are listeners, right? And a teacher needs to have the intelligence, the training, and the emotional resources and the time mm-hmm. to kind of see this, the specificity of kids to do that. And poor kids who come from difficult backgrounds need that more than anybody else, but get it less than anybody else.
Yeah. Valid point. Dan in Fond du Lac, hi.
Yeah, hi. Curious if your guests would know, how does Wisconsin spending per pupil compare nationally, and how does it compare to our immediate neighbors, specifically Iowa and Minnesota, which I think have similar economies?
It's a good question, and I don't have the answer. As I mentioned, Wisconsin cut per pupil spending by more than any other state except Alabama over the last 6 years, but I'm not going to pretend. I don't know the answer to that question.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. Let's go to Bill and Nina. Hi, Bill.
I'm trying to understand the economics of the attack on public education. I recall in the 90s, neoconservatives published a strategy called Starve the Beast, figuring that after public-funded services began to fail, they could then attack them and have them replaced with profit-making services. You see any of that happening?
Absolutely. I think there is definitely some of that happening. And, you know, if you think about particularly the switch to replacing teachers with digital applications, you know, once you create a digital application, the creation costs something. Once it's programmed, it doesn't cost any more to teach it to 100,000 kids than to 100. And a lot of these companies are transferring their applications to cell phone platforms because they want to sell to India and to English-speaking Africa. So I don't know what they're going to charge per kid in a country like Ghana, but if they're making a profit in Ghana, I just think how much more of a profit must they be making even in a poor city like Milwaukee. So that's, I don't think there's any question, that's not the whole story, but that is part of what's happening. And that is certainly why all of a sudden you have, I mean, for instance, you know, at the national level, there's an organization called Democrats for Education Reform. Democrats for Education Reform is basically Wall Street money that wants to do exactly what you said, and they're very powerful within the Democratic Party because they can give a lot of money to candidates, and because after Citizens United, there's people...
Can give even more money.
Yeah, people with a lot of money can give as much as they want, and there's no limit.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Rich in Woodstock. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I am a public school teacher, have been for 33 years, and I understand the concern. But one thing I am, I'll just put it real straightforward, I'm sick and tired, even in my place of employment, is the analysis of private versus public, voucher versus non-voucher. It's always seen as competition instead of complementary. I mean, most of the people I work with say any type of, you know, private school or a home school or anything like that is bad because it threatens public education. What they really mean is it threatens the structure of public education that ensures their job. What? Let me just finish before you jump on it. The issue here is, are we educating kids, and whether or not it's private or public, I've seen good people come out of, the good students come out of private education, homeschools, and I've seen terrible students come out of that. And I've also seen the same thing come out of all of our feeder schools in the public education system. There's people that are doing it just for money in public education. We have this idea that all the teachers are just in it because they love teaching and they're passionate about it, and that is absolutely true with some, and that is absolutely not true with others. And probably, I mean, you know, your guest kind of alluded to how he was tipping his hand, and the title of your so-called study... basically to bolster support of public education versus supporting education, period. You know, the question you asked, you know, about, you know, educating public or poor children versus rich children, it's kind of like a, you know, have you stopped beating your wife type of question.
All right, Rich. So it's really about education.
I mean, maybe to the caller's surprise, I mean, I agree with a lot of what he said. I think the key thing is, do you, you know, what's the quality of education for kids? And there's no doubt that there are kids who get good education in every kind of school, including homeschooling. The few places where I would disagree is, I would say, one thing is, it's one thing to say, oh, there's some people who have the job because they want to make money. I'm sure there's some of that every place. But the question is, are curricular decisions being made by the system on a for-profit basis? So, I mean, for instance, when I visited the Rocket Ship School here in Milwaukee, I said, you know, what if a teacher says, well, for this set of kids, I don't think this software program is right and I want to use a different one. Can they do that? No. I said, what if the principal of the school says, we don't think for our kids, this might be right in California, it's not good here. No. The only people who have the power to do that are the people in central office in California. And I think that's because they're making business decisions where they want to be able to make a contract for system-wide, and they don't allow local experimentation. That's a different order of financial interest than saying somebody wants a job. I completely agree with what he said, that it shouldn't be about protecting somebody's job or something like that. I do think that if you have taxpayer-funded schools, that those schools should be accountable to taxpayers in the same way, which means they should be governed by a board that's elected by parents or taxpayers, that they should have to obey the same transparency, the same ethics laws, and those kind of things. If you want to call them, you know, whatever you want to call them is fine. And the original idea of charter schools, of having experiments that other people could learn from, I think was a great idea.
Gordon, thank you very much for being with us. Gordon Lafer, our guest.
Thank you.
The report, I think it's on our Facebook page. If not, we'll put it there. It's a lengthy report, but it's definitely worth reading. It's very, very complete. Do poor kids deserve lower quality education than rich kids? Evaluating school privatization proposals in Milwaukee, done by the Economic Policy Institute, just released a couple hours ago. Gordon is a political economist, associate professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center, and he writes a lot about labor and employment policy. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this program, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for doing on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and then the second hour of our program today, we'll talk about humor, the funniest cities in the country, and humor around the world.